Well, good day and welcome back to the 5-Day Reading Plan Podcast. I'm Lance Ward, and as you know, each week I will review some of what we read together in the previous 5 days. Always remember, as you're subscribing to this, that you can download a PDF of this plan in the description of this podcast. Going into week 7, I'd like to share a word of advice today as you continue through this plan. You've probably figured it out by now, but one of the challenging aspects of reading through the Bible is coming across texts that are kind of hard to understand. Some texts may also rub us the wrong way or even shock us. This is especially true in some of the Old Testament texts we've already read together. When that happens, here's a couple pieces of advice. First of all, just thank God that you noticed it on your own. The worst thing that can happen is that you remain oblivious to such texts, then a teacher or skeptic comes along and brings it up, putting his or her own slant on it and possibly undermining your faith. Secondly, though, just go ahead and mark such texts. I just put a question mark outside or beside the texts that confuse me or I want to come back to. And then when the time comes, do some research and see what smarter folks have said over the centuries if you still are kind of confused. Believe me, whatever you may be seeing for the first time has been scrutinized and examined by hundreds of good and godly people. And if you do enough investigation yourself, you will likely find some resolution to any questions you might have. You may even find that there's more to the story than any immediate conclusions that you may have assumed. You know, before my kids went off to college, I told them that they would probably run across teachers and ideas that questioned the Bible and the faith they grew up with. They might hear things about the Bible that they've never read or objections they've never heard. So I assured them that there is a solid chance such things have been studied and resolved over the centuries, and what they would hear would be really nothing new. So keep that in mind whenever a text might confuse you or befuddle you or cause you to scratch your head, and then just keep reading. Speaking of which, our texts this week were Exodus 32 through 40, Leviticus 1 through 7, Philippians 3 and 4, Hebrews 1 through 3, and Psalms 26 and 27. As I'm reading through Exodus 32 strikes me much like Exodus chapter 5. In both chapters, the Israelites turn their backs on Moses and presume that negative outcomes were a sure indicator that Moses was not God's man for the job. In Exodus 32, we saw the Israelites grow tired of waiting on Moses, so they appointed Aaron to lead them. Then Aaron gave in to what they asked by making a golden calf to represent the God who rescued them. What a mistake! And Aaron's subjection to the will of the people is a reminder to us of what God-centered shepherds are called to do, to listen first to the Lord and to prioritize their calling by His voice, not the loud cries and objections of others. This does not mean, of course, that the sheep are never right, nor that they should never provide input. It does mean, though, that shepherds are first to be in tune with the Father when it comes to how shepherds guide the people. Exodus 34, verses 6 and 7 is the first of 8 Old Testament occurrences in which God is described this way, slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love. Interestingly, one of those 8 occurrences is in Jonah, where the prophet gets angry with God. Why does he get angry with God? Because he knew that God was a gracious God, and he didn't want God to be gracious toward the Ninevites. You see, in contrast to what we hear so often today, there are not 2 different gods in the Old and New Testament, a harsh and impatient God in the Old and a gracious, lovable grandfather who spoils us in the New Testament. Long before Christ came, the Lord had a reputation for being merciful, gracious, and kind. One other Exodus thought. I noted every reference to the heart in Exodus 35 as the text tells us about how the Israelites freely contributed materials for the tabernacle. In fact, in 36 verses 6 and 7, Moses had to tell Israel to stop giving because they were contributing too much, if you can imagine that. If we don't read our Bibles carefully, we may conclude that the Old Covenant was all about external behavior and giving that was begrudging, but the New Covenant is more about the heart and spontaneous generosity. Both Old and New Testaments, though, emphasize the importance of the heart in humanity's relationship to the Lord. Even when Israel was under the law, the Lord still looked upon the heart as the ultimate measure of devotion to Him. In the last couple of weeks, by the way, we've waded through a lot of minutiae in the law. It is important to ponder why all these instructions were actually a gift to Israel from God rather than a burden, especially when we think about the civil laws and all the specifics within them, especially in Exodus 21 through 23. And we will see this later in Leviticus and Deuteronomy with laws that refer to restitution and punishment for wrongdoing. Here is one perspective on this from a man named David McElroy. He writes, "Barring a significant change in human nature, the alternative to a society whose rules are enforced by legal penalties is not a society free from violence. It is a society divided by vendetta. Law is the process of subjecting the urge for vengeance to arbitration and regulation. The sentence passed by the judge is in lieu of the actions of the lynch mob or private assassin." In other words, what David McElroy is saying and what we see in Exodus, the civil laws given by God were for the purpose of consistent justice. They came from a perfectly just and gracious giver who understands how human nature tends to be ruled by the passions of the moment. Restitutions and penalties would be determined beforehand, therefore, from the mouth of the Lord. This principle, of course, remains true in any good and law-abiding society. We are not to be vigilantes when we are wronged. We are to allow the justice system and predetermined laws to take their course. And hopefully we live in a place where the justice system is not corrupt. I'm not sure how much truth there is to this, but rumor has it that Leviticus is where many folks put the kibosh on their Bible read-through. Maybe this has to do with the fact that it is a long list of instructions, and many of them are now obsolete, as the book of Hebrews will show. So if the Bible were indeed an instruction manual, have you ever thought about it this way? It would probably read like Leviticus all the way through. So aren't you glad that the Bible is more than that? Aren't you glad it is a redemption story with real people living real lives and sometimes messy lives? But as you trudge through all the details of Leviticus, I want you to keep in mind a couple of things. One, the overall message of the book. I like the way Pastor Kevin DeYoung has summarized it. He says this, "Leviticus, for all its weirdness and confusion, is about one thing. How can a holy God dwell in the midst of an unclean people?" Keep that theme in mind as you progress through Leviticus and watch how Leviticus answers that question. The second thing is you will observe a repetition of a few key terms, such as holy, pleasing aroma, atonement, and of course, all references to the priestly activities. When we consider how a holy God can dwell in the midst of unholy people, let's watch for what often comes between these people and their God, offerings and priests. Keep this second point in mind as you also read through Hebrews, and watch how the author of Hebrews points us to Christ as the final and sufficient offering, as well as the perfect and final high priest. Maybe when you see these two together, you'll see what I mean when I say the Bible is a redemption story. It's all tied together. So even if it seems irrelevant, Leviticus is far from irrelevant. It helps us to better see the big picture of God's plan and to cherish what we have in Christ. Psalm 27 provides a vivid picture of the true meaning of worship, putting God above all other things. I think we can conclude from Psalm 27:4 that God captured David's attention and his affections. In that sense, when I seek to gauge my own heart of worship, the two places I most explore in my life are those same two areas. What am I giving my attention to, and what is capturing my affections? Can you say that the living God has captured your attention and affections like he did David's in Psalm 27? That's a good diagnostic question that we can ask often. Philippians 3, verses 4 through 11 may contain one of the clearest New Testament sections on what the gospel is and what it is not. The gospel is not part grace and part human performance. It is not a lot of Christ and a little bit of us. The gospel is all about Christ and his work. In this paragraph, Paul sees the gospel as a complete repudiation of any religious or moral accolades and a total embrace of Christ as the only source of human hope. So in your testimony, in your story, is there any part of your story where your goodness, your efforts, your morality, or anything else is added to the work of Christ for you? Are there any subtle parts of your present life where you might be adding to God's grace just in case? Maybe ask yourself that. Is there any part of me that thinks I need to do something else to make sure that I'm accepted to God? We started reading Hebrews this week as well. Hebrews is an interesting book in a lot of ways, but one big way is the way the author seeks to make his points. In this sense, I've heard it said that Paul argues in sort of a step-by-step logical way in Romans. The author of Hebrews, however, hones in on his central point using another style of persuasion, Christ as the center of everything. All things in God's plan point to Christ, and not a single thing or being matches Christ. Good yet lesser things may exist on the periphery, things like angels in chapter 1 or Moses in chapters 1 and 2 or the Old Testament priesthood. But none can match the supremacy of God's Son. He is the centerpiece of it all. He is unmatched, even when compared to the best of the best in God's plan. So notice how the author utilizes this style of persuasion as you read through Hebrews. Sometimes in Hebrews, it sounds like a broken record, but keep in mind what he's doing in shaping his argument. He's constantly pointing us to Christ and making sure that we don't lose track of this, that Jesus is the center of everything. Also, take note of how Hebrews and Leviticus coincide in our readings. As you do, meditate on how Levitical law was the right thing for God's plan in that time, but how the law, especially the ceremonial part, was always meant to foreshadow something and someone better and more fulfilling. As Jesus would say in the Gospels, "I did not come to abolish the law, but to fulfill it." And Hebrews shows us that he is the fulfillment of that law. He fulfilled it in many ways, and Hebrews will highlight this as we read. Well, that's the end of this week's summary. Next week, we read Leviticus 8 through 23. We're going to look at three psalms, Psalm 31, 110, and 111. And watch out for how Psalm 110 and Hebrews, I think it's 7, we'll look at this next week, but how they match up. And then Hebrews 4 through 8. So that's it for this week. Hope you enjoy the weekend and keep reading.